This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Something like that, the order of the names is there to tell us something about the person. That Lavan answers immediately the question is whether Rivka is going to marry into this home or not. This is a major question as far as the family is concerned. Yes, Lavan has an opinion to pass, that's fine. But that he should be answering before Bethuel gives us some kind of understanding of Lavan's character. And one of the most important tests of character is the relationship to a parent. We spoke about the fact that Rivka's test was outside of the home, that she was tested out in the marketplace, she was tested at the well, and that there were reasons for that, because that's where you really see who she is, under the pressures of her peer group and under the pressures of the marketplace. You see she for herself much more than you see her in the home environment. But there's a second test that needs to take place, and that's the child in relationship to the parents. Because what that tells is not just the parental relationship, but it tells something about the entire value system, whether the child considers the source of knowledge to be the previous generation, or whether the child considers the source of knowledge to be the modern generation. Does the child put more value on technology or more value on values? If values are more important than technology, then you honor a parent. If technology is more important than values, then parents should honor children, because children can wear computers better than the parents can. So the way you treat a parent, if it's simplified radically, really says whether modernity or tradition is primary in your value system. And by Lavan's inserting himself before Bethuel, putting himself before Bethuel, he demonstrates that he has no value, he places no value on the tradition that is passed down from parent to child, from grandparent to grandchild, and so on. So we can begin to get a sense of this home. Vayomru, and they said, the two of them, May Hashem Yotzo Hadova, Lo Nuchal Daber Lechoro. So this is clearly from God. We can't even comment. There's no, you put such a case to us. There you go to this well and you make this deal with God, and look what happens. So you can't really be asking for our opinion. This is from God. You know, there's no point in us even passing an opinion. There's no way that we can compete with this kind of certainty. And now that's strange, isn't it? That take a person like Lavan, Bethuel we don't know very much about. But certainly a person like Lavan, who was party to the statement, on the one hand we're saying he doesn't value values, that he puts himself before his father, that he doesn't value the morality of it, he values only the modernity, and therefore youth is valued more than tradition. Why is he so godly all of a sudden? God and Baruch Hashem and Yitzchak Hashem, you can imagine the words that they were saying. And this is what it really tells us, that when they said, how are you, Lavan? Lavan must have said, Baruch Hashem. And when he said,
After he cleared out the idols.
And he says, it's very weird. What kind of people are these? Giving such credence to God's will and submitting themselves to such a degree to God's will, and yet showing no morality and no respect to their parents. Sorry?
Maybe God's will was their will, so they could respect that.
Well, let's have a look at that. Then they go on. Hinei Rivka Lefanecha. Now, Lavan we know is a bad guy, but Bethuel we're not sure about yet. So they say, Hinei Rivka Lefanecha. Here is Rivka. Take her and go. This is from God. This couldn't be anything better than this. Utehi Isho Leven Adonecho. Let her be a wife to the son of your master. Kasher Diber Hashem, as Hashem has said. The ultimate of religiousness. So Eliezer must be looking at these people and thinking, of all the families in the entire world, look what he's got. He's got the most religious people possible. As God says, so it should be. And when the servant of Avraham heard their words, Vayishtachu arzo laHashem. Those of you who've got a chumash in front of you should look at the phrasing of that. Linda, have you got the place there? You're still searching. Chof Dalet, 24... 52. He bowed down to the ground to Hashem. And we have a similar statement just a few sentences earlier in verse 26, where we have a whole verse that says just this, verse 26, after Rivka has passed the test, Vayikot ha'ish vayishtachu, and the man bowed down and prostrated himself, l'Hashem, to God. And on these verses, the Gemara says, and Rashi brings it on our verse, vayishtachu arto, on verse 52, says Rashi, mikan shemodim al b'soiro toivo. Here you see that you have to thank God for good news. When something good happens, you've got to thank God. This is where we learn it from. And the Gemara actually says it. Rashi brings it on this verse. The Gemara actually says it on the early verse. And it doesn't matter. He's done it twice, Eliezer. He's bowed down, and we're told, to Hashem. What I find interesting is the phrasing and the contrast between him and them. If you look at the phrasing of the trop, let's look in both verses. Start in verse 56, in verse 26. So if we phrase it according to the way the trop is, the phrasing is the following. Vayikod ha'ish, and the man bowed, vayishtachu, and he prostrated himself, comma, l'Hashem, to God. Look at the one in ours, 52. Vayishtachu arto, he bowed down to the God, to the ground, comma, l'Hashem, to God. Why that phrasing? Why doesn't it say he bowed down to God? How would you understand that? In both cases, it's carefully phrased. He bowed down to the ground, to God. Bow down
to the
God. No, another one's not to the ground, but it's also under the Vayishtachu is the tipcho, which is a closing bracket, a closing parenthesis. So it's almost Vayishtachu arto. Vayishtachu arto is in fact semicolon. It's more than a comma. Vayishtachu arto, semicolon, l'Hashem, to God. And from here we learn that you've got to thank God when you hear something good. What does that mean? Why here? My understanding of it is that if it wouldn't tell us that he bowed to God, nobody would know. Why is that important? I don't think it's that so much. I think it's that this wasn't to communicate to other people. This was personal. As far as the observer was concerned, this wasn't a religious act. It was internally religious. What are they busy doing? Baruch Hashem, and it's God's will, and please God, and thank God, and Emir to Hashem. Every second word was God's will. Eliezer hasn't said a thing. All he does is he bows down. As far as they're concerned, he doesn't know that he might be bowing down to them. As far as he's concerned, Hashem, the Torah wants us to know that who he was bowing down to was God. And it's telling us that because it wasn't clear from what he did. When we thank God, that's an internal thing. And that's one of the problems. That's why I always sort of semi-mock this Baruch Hashem business. Not because it's not important to thank God. Of course it's important to thank God for everything that one does. But it's become a display of religiousness rather than an internal feeling of true gratitude. And it's sometimes inconsistent with actions and with behavior, as we see in the case of Lavan and Betuah. On the one hand, we're seeing with the enormous God's will and thank God and how wonderful and please God and all of that. And we'll see their behavior in a moment. Whereas in Eliezer's case, it's completely discreet. The action is an action. As far as he's concerned, it's very clear to him what he's doing and why he's doing it on both cases. And it's on that the Gemara says, that's where you learn from, that you've got to thank God. From the way Eliezer does it. Eliezer does it with a major action and little ostentation. There's no ostentation in the act. There's no clear religiousness in there. Religion is something that is deeply internal and deeply personal. Linda? Yes. Yes, but he could have been bowing to them. Bowing was a form of greeting.
Okay.
It was a form of honor. So who he could have been bowing to? Idols. Nobody knew who he was. It wasn't important to anybody else who he was bowing down for. This wasn't to educate the world or to convey a message to the world. This was to say thank you to God.
Well, I have no problem with that.
Well, one does it with discrete action. The actions don't have to. There's a difference between externalize and ostentation. To perform an action is externalizing it. To do the action in a way that you make sure that everybody can see you doing it is ostentation. To do it in a discreet way. Lavan and Betuel are extremely ostentatious.
Mm-hmm.
In in the way they, there's an exaggeration considering who they were particularly, which is in stark contrast with Eliezer. Eliezer does talk about it when he recounts the story. He says, I prayed to God and God answered me, but he's just telling facts. He's telling a story in a very natural relationship. And God is part of my life. I talked to him, he answered me, he did this, he did that. But not Baruch Hashem. It's not a religious, it's a natural part of his life. And that's how God comes into his whole recounting of it. Blessed my master and gave him lots of wealth and so on. That's incredibly dangerous, because what that lands up, what that has landed up doing and is landing up doing, that doesn't mean that it's not an educational mechanism, but one has to understand how to use it. What that has tended to do is to create an almost entire generation of actors who've maintained the external and aren't dealing properly with the internal. And that's why we're dealing with all sorts of funny things that people are finding difficult to understand, why things are happening in religious communities today. Things that didn't used to happen, certainly not in the kind of proportion that they used to happen. And there is a sense that even after years and years and years and years, and we're finding it, something today that I predicted 20 years ago, we're finding young people who've been religious now for a long time, and sometimes their children dumping it at rather disturbing rates. Getting onto drugs. I mean, geez, religion was one protection at least against that. We never had that problem. So what is it? It hasn't been internalized. With all the acting and acting and acting, it hasn't been internalized. And we've got to face that. And the reason it hasn't been internalized is because there was too much emphasis on that being the method of education. Yes, you do stretch sometimes and do a little bit more than you feel, but do it in the non-ostentatious areas. That was always the Lithuanian message. If you're going to do something external, do it in the non-ostentatious areas. Do it in Ben Adam Lechaveru, do it in interhuman areas. Why do it in the man-God areas? You want to be very religious. Do more religious. Do more chesed than you feel like doing. Do more tzedakah than you feel like doing. Speak less lashon hara than you feel like doing. Why must it be in the man-God areas that you stretch yourself? Why is there this enormous emphasis on stretching yourself in things that can be seen, and so little emphasis in stretching yourself in things that cannot be seen? What is the message to the person? The message to the person is what's important is what can be seen. Clearly, that's where the whole educational emphasis is. There's no talk about stretch in chesed. Do a chesed. Do a chesed every day. Have a chesed program at school. Fantastic. How much chesed already? A big deal. They go once a week and visit somebody at the old age home. They visit an old person. Wonderful, great. But is that stretch? Is that like, you know, watch what you eat and don't go anywhere near this and don't go anywhere near that? The emphasis is clearly, the message to people and to young people particularly is clearly that in the things we can measure you in, that's where you grow religiously. And that's not the truth. Those should be the things that come naturally. Once the other things are being emphasized. And you see, as you watch this, the naturalness, if you learn Bereshit, one of the most astounding things about Bereshit is the naturalness of the forefathers. What are the stories all about? Life. Not about the religious things. Where does it say anywhere that Avraham put on tefillin? Where does it say anywhere how long Avraham's tzitzis were? Where does it say what kind of shechita Avraham used? It doesn't say. That's not what it's talking about. Did they do it? Sure. Chazal tell us that Avraham kept every single law of the rabbis and law of the Torah, everything Avraham kept. But it's not talked about. You don't see it. That's what needs to be there. Is it being done? Of course it's being done. Can you see it? No, you cannot see it. We've often had that discussion. Is it correct for a man to wear his tzitzit out or to wear his tzitzit in? What's the din? Which is more correct? To wear it out? Yeah, it's clearly to wear it out. The Mishnah Berurah, and they always quote you in the yeshivas, the young guys in the yeshivas, what's the Mishnah Berurah? You must wear your tzitzit out. Clear, but in the Mishnah Berurah's day, nobody would take his jacket off. So it's all very well with your...
They don't teach that part.
And of course they don't teach that part. Of course they don't teach that part. They teach the one half and not the other. Of course everybody wore their tzitzit out, but they used to wear long jackets.
I know.
Or short jackets.
Why would they call it out then if it wasn't showing?
Outside of your trousers is all the Mishnah Berurah says. Don't tuck them into your trousers. This is something to be proud of. Why tuck them into your trousers? Not a place for tzitzit.
It's not saying.
To who? It says, Ura'isem Oisoy, so that you will see the tzitzit. Not that everybody else will see your tzitzit. That's all it says. And the Mishnah Berurah doesn't say the reason you must wear it out is because people must see it. He just says because it's a source of pride. Why tuck something away that is a source of pride? But pride to who? Pride to you. So we're but those to wear jackets. They didn't used to take their jackets off during the day. They didn't, never. Taking your jacket off was like, you know what it was like that, not just in Jewish society, until fairly recently, even in non-Jewish society, you didn't take your jacket off. So fine, wear your tzitzis up. That's just an example of where the message constantly has shifted from doing the Bein Odom L'Mokom for yourself in an external way. Sure, in an external way. Wear tzitzis. But if you're sure that nobody else can see your tzitzis, then you know the reason you're wearing them is to stretch yourself. When you're doing something that other people can see, you don't do it. In Lithuania, there was a very simple rule in the yeshivas. Anything that can be seen, don't be a machmir on. If you want to be a machmir, if you want to take a severe route, only in areas that nobody else can see. Don't be a machmir on something that anybody else can see, because the chances are you're not doing it because you want to be a machmir. The chances are because it's a status thing. And that whole message has been lost. So clearly it's become an act. And it's being entrenched as an act. And entrenched, and people are going... The thought was, eventually it will become natural. And I claimed 20 years ago, well, why should it become natural? What is there that's going to make it become natural? Everything is reinforcing the act. So you're building the shell around the person whose inside is not being developed. You develop the inside by getting off the frum stuff and getting onto the learning. And let the frum stuff come as an outcome of the learning, not as an imposition. As a person learns and he gets to know, little by little he starts taking on, and don't rush it. Rush the learning. Become wise. Emphasize the learning. Become wise. You've got to get knowledge. You've got to have understanding. That's where the urgency should be. And not just learning for the sake of how much did you learn today. What did you understand today? My kid comes home from school. What does the father ask him? What did you learn today? What does he mean by that? What is the meaning of that question? What did you learn today? How many verses of Chumash? How many Mishnahs? That's what the meaning is. The meaning is not, what did you learn today that changes your understanding of the world? In what way do you understand the world differently today from the way you understood it yesterday? Imagine if we asked our children those questions. And the child would say, nothing. Well, then let's go through and see what you learned. And let's see if from what you learned we can develop a different understanding of the world. That develops a relationship with the Torah. Otherwise, the Torah is chimpanzee stuff. You can train the chimpanzee to do all the mitzvahs. It doesn't mean he becomes a frum Jew. You can get the chimpanzee putting on tzitzit, you can get him putting on tefillin, you can get him eating lot kosher, you can get him keeping Shabbos, you can even get him knowing when it is Shabbos and when it isn't. He can probably light Friday night candles too. That doesn't make him a Jew. Isn't that so? You worried about this? Yeah. For your question of what I've been saying, if I'm not scared, why are you so scared?
Okay.
Yes, it should say no scotch, no wine, no beer. You want a soft drink, have a soft drink. But what we don't want, because what is the law? The law is to avoid intermarriage. The law is to avoid intimacy. So what creates intimacy? Everybody knows you have a few drinks and you get intimate. But it works as well with scotch as it does with wine. So why doesn't, if the Torah knows that it's going to be other forms of alcohol too, why isn't the prohibition on all forms of alcohol? Why is it only on wine?
Doesn't the one here have a normal interaction? Do you remember the fact that
That's the whole question. Is that if we take the view that it's just to avoid any possibility of intermarriage, then all alcohol should be prohibited. What is the mechanism of avoiding intermarriage? Don't get drunk, don't have a drink, or is the mechanism remember who you are, remember who you are, remember who you are? That's the message. Just remember who you are. Don't tell everybody else who you are. It's not their business who you are. They're not interested in who you are. They know you're a Jew. Don't worry. And if you forget who you are, they will remind you. So you don't have to remind them who you are. They will never forget who you are. And they have awful ways of reminding you. And God makes sure that they remind us when we forget. If you want to avoid anti-Semitism, remember who you are. Stop throwing at them who you are. And what we do is the opposite. We forget who we are, but we keep on telling them who we are. We throw the ostentationism at them. We're Jews, we're Jews, we're Jews. But ourselves, we're not Jews. And that's the whole problem. We've missed the point completely. And when you realize how radically off the course we are, we're exactly the opposite of what the Torah is trying to teach us. Why? Because we're teaching the law and not the learning. We're teaching the law and not the understanding. We're asking our children, what did you learn, not what did you understand today. We're not teaching them about life. We're teaching them about a list of do's and don'ts. They don't understand the reason. They're told you don't have to understand the reason for it. And therefore the implementation of it is in a stupid, unintelligent sort of way. And we're not getting any closer to God. All we're doing is we're becoming more dogmatic with more and more rules that govern us. We become driven by compulsions rather than by values. And then we wonder why the kids drop it. Of course they would drop it. Why would they not drop it?
Rabbi, seems to me that this is an area which causes a great deal of pain for many families and friendship circles, where there is a sense that I have to separate myself from others in order to be true to my religious beliefs. And so you see this all the time. I can't eat in your house, or I won't eat in this one's house. And parents are crushed, and the friends don't understand. And so what I'm wondering is where this misunderstanding comes from, and why the teaching isn't different, yet why it isn't focused on the meeting ground as opposed to separation.
I think that's a critical question, and I think that there are a number of different reasons that happen to have emerged in the last 30 years or so. I think the one reason was the Second World War. Just wiped out our tradition. So you had arising a whole generation of teachers who were not taught. Teachers who picked it up from, you know, teach yourself and how to be and all that kind of thing. We have a generation of teachers who don't have tradition. I was stunned to find when I went back to Johannesburg, I've become the talking point in Johannesburg. Now that I've left, everybody's talking about me. So one of the things they're saying is they're trying to figure out why the shiurim were so big, what did I have that others don't have. It's an interesting discussion, so I was probing to try and find out about it. And one rabbi said to somebody, yes, Rabbi Lassen's shiurim used to be innovative and he had a way, but you need to understand religion is different today. I can't buy that. To me, that's reform. Once you start with religion is different today, we can't do that anymore. We don't have the sources of tradition to do that anymore. We're justifying a Khomeiniism in our own religion. But where it comes from is people who haven't been trained, people who haven't been taught by people who have been taught by people who have been taught. So the whole tradition broke off. Number two, there was an urgency after the war to create a religious society. It didn't exist. There wasn't a religious society after the war. It was the first time. It was a terrible thing. Just imagine what that was. You had thriving cities of religious people in all walks of life. You had such richness of religious life, and then a barren desert. All of a sudden, just nothing. There was nothing. There was nothing here in the United States. There was nothing in Europe. Israel didn't exist. We've got to actually try and picture what 1946 was like. There was nothing. There were individuals spotted around who were considered archaic and out of it and blamed for the Holocaust. So it wasn't fashionable. It just wasn't the done thing. And right through the 50s, religion was in very bad, very much out of fashion. The 50s being the age of science, and religion was unscientific, and it was archaic. And right through the 50s, it was very unfashionable to be religious, not just Jewish, any religion. The 60s was the hippie time, the free time, very unfashionable to be religious. During all of that time, the religious world was struggling against all of those forces to establish a religious society. The 70s was the break, when the world became open to things that aren't scientific, when they recognized that the 60s were a failure, that there was disappointment. The 70s was the time that both science and freedom failed to satisfy the quest for spirituality, and the world began its search for spirituality in the 70s. And then there was this outburst of religious awareness, both in our religion and in other religions. So there was this merciless drive to recreate a religious society. And of course, the society exists primarily, certainly in the short term. If you want to create a society, you do it by externals, not by internals. If you want to differentiate people, you've got to wear a uniform, you've got to live in a place, you've got to do the same kind of things. So when you're artificially creating a society, there's a danger and in fact a need to use externals to create the society. So I think that was one of the dynamics. So that's two dynamics. Number one, you don't have teachers who understand. And number two, you have this urgency to create the society. Number three, I think that that as we've spoken before, a lot of what attracts people into religion today is the separation. They want to be valued differently. They want acceptance, a sort of an unconditional acceptance. And a religious community is very warm and embracing if you accept. If you're willing to do what they want you to do, you accept it no matter who or what you are. It's a very... I found, Sharon, I don't know if you found it in Baltimore, a sense of I could understand what makes a person give up his everything, because you look at it at a community like Baltimore, it is so warm and embracing. You are accepted so unconditionally as long as you toe the line, but then it's unconditional. So So, and I'm not talking specifically about that community. That's probably one of the greatest of the communities that exist. But if you take even in that community, what would be in a community like that? If you wear the right clothes, eat the right meat, go to a shir every day, you're a davening three times a day, but you're not so straight in business. I don't think you would have a problem with acceptance. The externals would determine your acceptance. Doesn't mean that that's what they teach or that that's what they approve of. No, but society-wise, the society would embrace you. So you're embraced societally or socially by externals. And that's very comforting. So I think that's been a drive, that people want that separation. When they go back to their... It's very comforting for somebody to say, so-and-so doesn't like me because I'm religious. My boss fired me because I'm religious. My brother doesn't talk to me because, you see, I'm religious and he doesn't understand. That's not an excuse. If somebody's not talking to you, it's because either you or he aren't behaving yourselves. You just haven't got a relationship. But it's very comforting to say, I'm religious. And that excuses me from all the consequences of being antisocial, of being a social misfit. I can blame any form of non-acceptance on that. And the religious community accepts me. All I have to do is wear my sitzit out and say the Baruch Hashem and the Yirtzeh Hashem and eat the right meat and do the right things. And then my society will accept me. And anybody who doesn't accept me, it's because I'm religious. And then what happens when other religious people don't accept you? Well, that's a different school of religion. You know, they're modern Orthodox, or they're Hasidim, or they're this, or they're that. And you start narrowing and narrowing and narrowing, so the only kosher people are the people who accept you. Instead of wanting to be accepted by kosher people, I mean kosher in the broad sense, you start defining who's okay and who isn't by those who accept you and those who don't. So if I'm not accepted, it's because they're of a different school and they're not real. They're not. The whole thing starts becoming then narrower and narrower and narrower. So I think all these dynamics are causing the tendency to use religion as an external separation. It is separation. I'm not suggesting that religion is not a separation. Of course it's a separation. We are totally different from the non-Jewish world. We're not the same species, the Kuzari says. We are as different from the non-Jewish world as the animal world is from the human world. We are totally different. We function differently. Our psyche is different. Our health system is different. Our genes are different. Our value system is different. Everything's different. But we're the ones who have to be conscious of that difference. We have the capacity to engage in a way that we're conscious of that difference rather than they're conscious of that difference. And that applies secular Jewish world as much as in the non-Jewish world. Certainly today, where the secular Jewish world is secular not out of denial of God, but out of ignorance of God. Where it's out of denial of God, that's a different story. One doesn't have to be extremely sensitive to people who are knowingly denying God. But to people who have never been trained in God, who've never been taught what this is and have no knowledge of it, no experience of it, our relationship with them has to be an engaging one, not a disengaging one. And while we engage, yes, we do face dangers. And what is the protection against those dangers is our internal value system, how we view ourselves, not how we're viewed by other people. And that becomes critically important to understand and appreciate.
We should know before Thanksgiving and before holidays exactly what we can do.
About what? What you can do about what?
What we can eat on.
You
what
can
we
eat.
Can do.
Before Thanksgiving? Oh, you mean because people are going to families and things like that? Yeah, maybe I need to give a share some time on
it's been helpful. I mean, that has been a long time ago, and a long time ago, it's not to separate yourself. It'd be nice to know, like, the
practicalities of how to do it.
The practicalities of it all.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, one is to do it.
So you don't intend on other people. You know, I think a lot of us have, you know, figured out, you know, how not to, but, you know, it'd be nice to know.
You'll be able to do it provided the other party wants to have you.
Correct.
If the other party doesn't want to have you, they'll make your,
right,
whatever your requirements are, an excuse.
If they don't want, I mean, like, I'm saying, there's a lot of issues around food for people, because they want to cook for you, you know, but, and so there's a good,
how they can do that.
How they can do it. So it makes them feel like this, because there is no other opportunity, usually during the year, for them to do.
I thought about it earlier, it would have been for this time of the year, and I didn't even think about it. This is the time of the year when this really comes up for people, and we should do that, but we'll do it well before next year, and I think we need to do that quite soon.
It could be, it doesn't even have to be set in time. It's just,
yeah,
in general, it helps.
So there are two parts to it that we'll have to do. The one is the practicality of what you can and cannot do, and the other is the whole issue of Murray's eye and the people throw at you of appearance to make sure that what you're doing is correct and appears correct. But while you're trying to engage in a seamless way, what you, it's not only good enough to do it right, it has to be done in a way that appears right. And what those conditions are and how to be able to do that. And yes, that can be done in a way where nobody, somebody who's looking will notice that what you're doing is different, but somebody who's not looking will not notice. That's the key to it. Greater education is there than to know, yes, they do drive because they don't, on a Shabbos, because they don't understand or they haven't learnt yet. And there's no reason to protect children from the knowledge of different people at different levels doing different things and their own choices and why we choose to do what we do. Why should they think that we do it because there is no other choice? The whole of modern religious education is to dupe the children into thinking that there's no choice. Rather than saying, there are millions of choices, and this is what we choose to do. That person chose to do something else, and this is why we've chosen to do what we do. Isn't that a much greater education than for the child to go and think until he's 11 or 12 or 13 or 15 that there are no alternatives? And then when he suddenly discovers alternatives, he said, and he resents it. And as a teenager, he wants to explore those alternatives because he was never given the choice. He was never told there was a choice. It's such a cockeyed sort of education. The whole educational system is based, and all of this that we're discussing is based on the presumption that the only way people will follow Torah is if they think there's nothing better. Whereas it should be, Torah can compete. That there's nothing that we need to manage. It's hard to compete. Sure, competition's tough. That means the way we present the Torah has to be dynamic, and the way we teach the Torah has to be dynamic. It creates much more obligation on the teachers. But isn't that their job? Yes, each person is free to choose. God allows each person to make his own choices.
Why do you want your kids to see your parents not making that?
Why not? Why not? Why not? I'm very thankful to God. Do you understand? You say to your child, do you understand what it was for me to make this choice? I was brought up in their home,
right,
and that was their choice. And for me to make this choice, you must understand how I was attracted to it. You must understand how powerful it is. For me to decide after seeing that I would rather be doing this. Do you know what that does to a child? Instead of making the child think that there wasn't a choice in the process? One of the greatest things we have to teach is that
it's
a choice.
I'm not saying that there wasn't a choice. I'm just saying that how do you still keep a respect for, keep it all in, you know, for your own parents?
Because you don't judge people by their choices. I mean, you judge the action, but not the person. So if the child says, is breaking Shabbat right? No, breaking Shabbat is not right. Is granny wrong? Is granny bad? Or grandpa? No, they're not. The action is not, they're not bad. The action, in, according to my discourse, the way we understand the Torah, the action is not right. So why do they do that? Well, they've chosen to do that. People sometimes choose to do things. Sometimes they don't know that it's wrong. Sometimes they don't understand. And sometimes they do, and they still decide. I think the art is to be able to train a person to judge the action and not the person. Imagine if we had trained a generation of people that knew how to judge actions and not people. Imagine what a world we would have. I'm intolerant of a wrong action, and I'm totally tolerant of a person. And that's the whole controversy at the moment with the Museum of Tolerance as to whether there should be a tolerance for gays section. And the whole issue is, can one teach people to be tolerant of people, but not of an action? And as far as children are concerned, imagine what kind of children, what kind of adults we would be producing if we'd got that message. Leave aside all the other messages, just the message of you do judge. If you look at modern society, take American society today, we are extremely judgmental of people and completely tolerant of action. Isn't that what the society is? Everybody, we've got something to say about everybody, but we've got nothing but actions. Everybody's, everything's kosher, everything, as long as you don't murder and rape. That's the only thing we're not tolerant of. But everything else is each man's own choice. But people, we're not. It's exactly the reverse. Do not tolerate those actions. There are certain actions that are not to be tolerated, but that doesn't mean the man's a bad man or the person's a bad man. We all do wrong things. Don't judge the person, judge the action. Imagine if we brought up a generation that knew only that. That's the only thing they knew of Torah. We would be better off than we are today. Okay.